Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
And welcome to an hour of mind power. Well, for all of you sports buffs out there, we're going to be talking about a game that I have to tell you I'm not real familiar with, but the story that we're going to be talking about was just mesmerizing to me because the gentleman that wrote the story, Seahawk, Confessions of an Old Hockey Goalie. We are going to be sort of slipping and sliding back into the past, into the days when people didn't play hockey like they do today. It was a little bit different. Bruce Valley, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's an absolute delight. When I got your book, I thought, now what in the world? I'm not a real sports person, like I said, and I'm just going, you know, hockey's sort of interesting, but it's never been a sport that I've just been gung-ho about because it's pretty rough and tumble, and I just go, nah. But your book was wonderful. It really would, if somebody wasn't interested in hockey, I think if they got the chance to read it, they would find it fascinating, and your photos in here are just absolutely terrific. Now,
well,
I want my
you.
Audience to know that you used to be a Navy test pilot, and you've been an amateur hockey goaltender for almost 60 years. That's amazing. I thought after 30, your knees wouldn't hold up. But you're still playing, and you're a chief executive of the Aerospace Corporation in Alexandria, Virginia, that you founded. And you've got a wonderful family, and you have grandchildren that are currently hockey players. Bruce, why do you think that this sport was so important to you that it became such a part of your life? Most people I know that have been active in sports after they're 30, 35, they go, my body can't take it. 6 years later, you're still involved with it. How can that possibly be?
Well, I think at least part of it is I grew up in the culture of a small town in New England where hockey was a very important thing, and it just happened that a group of men returning from World War II found companionship and something to do when there weren't a lot of jobs playing the game, and that group became a town team, went on to play all over New England and had quite a successful run for 16 years. And I just happened to be adjacent to it, looking down as a little boy out of an apartment window, and then later when I was a teenager, again, sort of by happenstance, the team lost its goalie, and there was no other goalie. I was the goalie on their sort of kids team, and so at 14, I started touring New England with a group of 30-year-olds. It was quite an interesting 2 years.
Oh, I can imagine how the world has changed relative to the game. Now, Ken Lintzman of the Boston Bruins said, Seahawk is a wonderfully entertaining book that looks at the vintage amateur hockey in post-World War II New England and your inside look at the challenges of both goaltending and the aging process in sports. You're not holding anything back, according to Ken. And he lives in New Hampshire, and he skates on frozen ponds during winter with his own children and surfing buddies, he says, and the book that you wrote brought home to him how important things are. Life, they don't really change very much, and it reminds me how very cool, he says, life must have been in the long-ago era that your book, Seahawk, describes. And it is magical. When I started reading the book, I thought, wow, this is really fun, because you gave such a wonderfully colorful description of the environment that you grew up in. And I wanted to share, right at the beginning of the book, you have Sweet Solitude. This is something that you wrote. Said, daylight still eludes the cold so pervasive it reaches through clothes and skin to your bones. A deep silence reigns over the shadowed pond, stillness everywhere. No possibility of snow at such temperatures or of lacing skates unless the job is done quickly. Taking a first stride as I slip gloves on and reach reflexively for a puck from my pocket, I see before me in the pre-dawn that magical surface of which all hockey players dream, an endless expanse of unbroken, untouched, gleaming black ice. Alone, I poke amiably at the black disc with my old Northland thrall dimming in a circuit, dodging and weaving to fend off imaginary foes. Crisp sound of blades cutting ice rests in the frigid air. The birches seem to quiver at the noise. An owl stares down from the height of an old oak, unimpressed. What a description! It was very, very, just very good as a writer. You paint pictures with words that I think are fabulous. Now, you bring up in your introduction about something that always bothered me, and that was the very violent side of hockey. And you talk about the difference between yesterday and today. How has it changed?
Well, the game, like all games, has evolved, Anna. The equipment has undergone enormous change, and that alone has made the number of injuries much smaller in number than in my era, when helmets and masks were not worn, and therefore bare faces faced a game that is fast and is somewhat brutal. Secondly, I think that the rules of the game have changed to try to keep people from being injured, and I play now against young men in their teenage years or their 20s, and it is rare for me to see someone that has lost a tooth or has a facial scar, where in my era, anybody that played this game as a serious amateur and certainly as a professional had all of the visible features of a hockey player, and people would know right away that was the sport they played.
Mm-hmm. You describe how, when you were a young boy, these combat veterans, when they came home, they really were a special breed of man. Tell us how, as a young man, you felt about these combat veterans.
I think the best way to do that is to recall for you and for your listeners the movie that came out a few years ago, Saving Private Ryan. Is that something you remember?
Oh, yes.
That had several moments in it that, as I watched it, reminded me very much of the men that I had grown up with and played with on that team now 50 years ago. First, the sheer effort that was required to go and find that young man who was the last of his family alive. Several boys had already been killed in the war, and the War Department was making an effort to extract him before the family had no sons left. And when they found the young man, he didn't want to leave his buddies, even though they were in a situation which was very dire. And in the combat action that followed, the leader of the group that had gone to find him is mortally wounded. And as he dies, looks up at that young boy and says, "Make something out of this," meaning mm-hmm. live a life deserving of all that you've seen here today. The movie ends with that man, an old man, going back to visit the grave decades later of that trooper that had been killed, and saluting his grave, and then turning around and in a moment that any one of us that's worn a uniform I know would find transfixing, turning to his wife and saying, "Was I a good man? Did I lead a good life?" And these were the people that I met on the ice in Rye, New Hampshire, at Seacoast along the Atlantic, who had a stoicism, a discipline, a strength of character, an ability to work almost without end, that I don't think I see anymore in our society, and I think we're the poorer for it.
Mm-hmm. You describe them as being two dozen scrappy World War II veterans creating a hockey club. They built their own rink. They outfitted and equipped themselves, and then they fought their way to a winning season completely on their own. Now, this was a time when you didn't have to go and get 45 permits to do something. I mean, this was a time when someone would say, "Well, why don't we go and do this? And we've got the frozen ponds. Why don't we do this, this, and this?" And they got together and said, "Okay, let's go do it." And they had total responsibility for everything that they did. But also, you bring out a point that I think is very significant, and that is, at the time, there wasn't any television. There was just the radio, AM, and most entertainment, especially during winter, was you either had to be a good reader or you enjoyed freezing to death when you stepped outside, because the nearest movie theater was 8 miles away, and you made the comment that it would show the same film for weeks at a time. Good gracious. Compare that with today. We have it every one new one every 30 minutes, it seems like.
Well, I'm listening to you say that, and I'm thinking, boy, that was pretty trying time. There was so little to do it, and that was part of the reason the town was so supportive of the hockey team. It was their one of their few venues for entertainment. On the other hand, if I look at it in the other direction, it seems as if looking at young people, particularly these days, they are so deluged with stimuli that I'm not sure any of it has a lot of meaning. With the texting and twittering and
mm-hmm.
and Blackberries and internet and all the things that they have going for them. Whereas in the 1940s and 1950s, those of us who I feel were very privileged to grow up in that time, you had a nation that had gone through a long paroxysm of the Great Depression and then the World War. And now you were seeing economic growth and peace and stability for the first time. There was a sense of pleasant wonderment at all these good things happening to the adults and to the kids that made you, I think, much more deeply appreciative of the small things, of the walk along the sea or the skating on the pond.
Mm-hmm. Well, and two, I think what happens, and this is something that when young people have an opportunity to experience it today, they don't forget it very readily, but to entertain yourself, to develop that comradeship. And I think some of it is still done. It's done differently. But when you are in a pretty harsh, cold environment like this, you become quite creative. And I think that is one of the benefits when you don't have all the distractions, that you're able to discover maybe some very creative sides about yourself. I had to chuckle when you talked about becoming a young goaltender, because you say any goaltender, a young one in today's game, would probably pass out cold if he was asked to enter a game dressed as we were. What were your uniforms like then?
Well, the uniforms were quite primitive. I guess when I think about it, everything there was quite primitive because, as you've already told your audience, it was all handmade, the boards, the lights, the posts. The ice itself, which was maintained daily by men and boys, most of whom had 5 days or more of full-time work in addition to practicing playing and maintaining that ice, which some did for 16 years. But the time, again, getting back to the time and its simplicity, I think in that era, that any moment, whether the weather was as cold as you describe, and it was, or warm in the summer, that we did not have assigned duties around our house or had to be in school, everyone I knew was running through the woods, playing some game, on the beach swimming, doing something which they determined how to do. There was very little adult supervision. Mostly we found things to do on our own and had a whale of a time. And that million hours of energetic pleasure is one of the great memories of my life.
Yes. And I think, sadly, that's something that a lot of young people today don't have the opportunity of being able to experience, is just that wonderful freedom of running and playing and doing. And sometimes I think we've become too overly protective. Now, your hockey sticks were different. Now, I just want to go through a couple of things. Upper body protection, you typically wore a baseball catcher's chest protection. That, if you have ever seen any of the old movies, they show the movies, like the baseball movies, they'll have the catcher's piece that they have the chest protector. And that wasn't much of a chest protector compared to what we have today.
No, and the weakness of the chest protector was that it had no protection at all for your arms. You wore heavy gloves, a catching glove, like a first baseman's mitt on your catching hand, and then what's called a blocker, which is sort of a board on top of a glove to ward off shots with the hand that holds the stick. But from the top of those gloves in the mid-forearm up and past your shoulder was was open, as was the space around your neck and sort of on your sides as well. And this was just the custom of the time. In defense of what sounds like extremely insufficient protection of the upper body, I would have to say that until about 1959, which was toward the end of my playing on that team, what is called a slap shot, which is a sort of golf shot which travels at very high velocity, speeds of over 100 miles an hour, had not yet been devised by the skaters, hockey skaters, and thus a much slower shot, probably two-thirds as fast, called a wrist shot, which could be shot forehand or backhand, was what goalies had to contend with. And so, in fact, there was a little less need for protection, although a lot of people were still injured.
So you had goalie pads, lower leg goalie pads, and you used white canvas for that, but you padded it with different materials so that you could protect yourself, and part of that padding might be horsehair stuffing. And you'd say after you finish the game, this horsehair stuffing would be all over the ice.
Yeah,
it would come out of whatever
they
put into
it. The pads were actually from the 1930s, I believe, as well as I understand vintage hockey gear, made of canvas. They had not decided yet to use leather, but both usually were stuffed with horsehair. And because they had been around for 20-something years at that time and had suffered the indignity of having skate blades or sticks hit them enough times to have caused some cuts here and there, a sort of fine fur of horsehair would dribble out of those holes all through the game. By the end of the game, it was a furred crease that the goalie was standing in.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about how the skates at that time, they had developed them so it protected the feet, because that is really significant. Those blades are really, really sharp. But as a goalie, I mean, you had stuff that was hit towards you that could go anywhere, and so you were really vulnerable. Now, you had a habit, apparently, as a goalie. You'd get pretty uptight, and you'd smash your stick, and you learned at a certain time that was no longer appropriate. What was that experience that taught you that habit had to change?
Well, first, the goal sticks today are roughly $200 per, which is still seems like a lot of money to me. But then the goal stick was $5 per stick, which then was probably an equivalent amount of money to the $200. And youthful indiscretion of a young goalie who played on the edges of adrenaline and I guess fury made me feel that any goal that went by was something I should be angry about, which would then sort of pump me up to make the rest of them stay out. And I used to turn and bang the stick over the top of the goal, which was metal, and I broke a couple. And one of the older veteran players skated by one day and let me know that the club existed on a very, very small budget, which was mostly put together by themselves, and that if I broke one more stick, that they would have to have me play with a regular player stick, which is quite a difficulty because the goal stick is like a big paddle and offers another surface to stop the puck from going in. The smaller stick would not give you that. Thus, I would be deprived of my ability to stop a puck with a stick. I got the idea right away and stopped smashing the stick over the goal.
On the other side of the coin, you had a gentleman by the name of Bob Lovett. And he was a very special man for you to be around. And you said when he was on the ice, you could almost relax because he was quite a player. But there was an incident when there was a burly centerman that really was giving you a tough time and was roughing you up. And all of a sudden, Lovett comes in and he faced the center and said, and asked him if he knew how old you were. And he didn't respond very well. And he said, well, he's 14. If you touch him again tonight, I'll kill you. That was the end of your being roughed up. What an experience at 14 years of age to have somebody stand up for you like that. That must have been really awesome.
As it happens, I've met Bob Lovett for the first time in almost 40 years.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Just a couple of weeks ago when the New Hampshire Legends of Hockey in New Hampshire, which is sort of a group of All-Americans and All-Stars, had a reception for the book Seahawk and invited the remaining living Seahawks, which is small in number from the original team, as you might expect. I think there were four there.
Mm-hmm.
To come, and Bob came up from somewhere in Massachusetts where he now lives, and his first question when he met me, and he had read the book, was I really that much of a monster? And I looked at him and I said, well, I wasn't 100% sure myself, because memory, of course, is only as good as it is, but I asked six other people that played, and every one of them corroborated the story.
Oh, that's so much fun. Well, what a pleasure to meet him after so many years. My goodness. But I love another side of your story. And that is, and again, we're talking of an era when the men would want to get to play like this. The women would make the cakes and the cookies and make sure that the coffee pot was going and all of this, and everybody's out in the bitter cold cheering you guys on. But to be able to prepare for the competitions you entered into, you had competitors, and they were from the St. Francis Friary, and there were 100 of the brothers. They were all pretty young, and you said you believed that each of them had either been an All-State or an All-American athlete in some sport, because these guys were so good. But what I loved the best, and I'll quote from your book exactly, those dark-robed Ernst young men, so quiet, so modest, so peace-loving, delivered absolute carnage on court and pond, and there was never any turn the other cheek in those games. Instead, they favored a strictly Old Testament style of brutally effective play. And I thought, I could just see that. Were they wearing their habits when they were out on the ice?
No, they didn't do anything that would limit their wonderful talent. They were wearing trousers and sweaters and jackets and gloves, and they were administering a terrible whopping on the boys of Rye, whether it was on the basketball court or particularly on the hockey court. And what was always so interesting was to have seen them walking around with a good book in their hand, in their habit, quietly contemplating, and then to see the same person that afternoon or that weekend on the ice, tearing up and down the ice and administering heavy body blows on the opposition. It was just such a contrast. You almost couldn't imagine these were the same people, but they were.
This would make a great movie. It really would. I just think, just seeing a bunch of them out there on the ice, and it's like, sorry, guys, we're out here on the ice. All of the Brotherhood is in a different modem. I just think that's great. And you know, you guys were pretty hardy. You kids were really hardy, and you just loved the game. And, of course, you had your share of injuries, and one of them was done by a Rick Osier, I believe it is, of Spokane, Washington. And he really whacked you with a puck.
Yes, he did.
And tell us what happened when you tried to contact him when you were putting this book together. You contacted him. Tell us that conversation.
I had done all of the interviews that were local, particularly the older gentlemen, hoping that I would be able to spend sufficient time with them to get all of their story while they were living. And then several more in a sort of wider radius, say certainly in New England. And then finally, there were another half dozen or so that had moved some distance, and it took a little bit to get a telephone number or an email address to make contact. And finally, one member of Rick Acer, O-E-S-E-R, Acer's family, gave me a phone number in Spokane, and I called. And when I told him who I was, there was no answer. He answered the phone and said hello. And when I said, this is Bruce Valley. You and I played hockey on a Rye, New Hampshire team in the late 1950s, and I'm writing a book, and I'd be happy if you'd answer a few questions and tell me a few of your anecdotes. And there was just an absolute silence, and I thought maybe the line had dropped. But so I asked again, and then I think I asked a third time, and finally he said, I waited 20 or 25 years for your parents to sue me. And I was just such a unexpected statement. And I thought, what are we talking about here? And so I asked, and he said, yeah, when I hit you in the face with a shot, which wasn't his fault at all. I mean, it was just a game, and I couldn't get out of the way. But he said, I was just sure your parents would be suing me because it sort of disfigured your right eyebrow. And I had to reassure him a little bit before we could have our conversation, but I did, and he was reassured, and we went on, had a wonderful interview. But it's just one that when you write a book, you don't know how many unusual and startling little events are going to occur in the writing itself, and that was certainly one of them for me.
Now, you have to tell us about the pink garter. That, okay, for those of you listening, just imagine guys putting on, in that time era, putting on pink garters before playing a game. You've got to tell us how that developed.
Well, these were big, tough guys, combat veterans, just returned from World War II. They had decided to form a team. They had spent the money necessary to equip it, which I suspect was very hard found, given that there were few jobs at the time. And many of them were on the government's 2010 program, which gave them some cash each month while they kept looking for work, so on. And they had successfully bought the uniforms, meaning socks, pants, and jerseys, and each had their own skates. And into that, you just needed to have a pair of gloves and a stick, and you were ready to play the game. But they discovered the last week that there were no athletic garters available. The socks on a hockey player come up to the upper thigh. They're underneath his pants, and they need to stay up because from the knee down is a shin guard covering the front of the leg to protect it from sticks and pucks. So with the socks not standing up, the shin guards would be falling out and just be an unbearable embarrassment on the ice. And therefore, they looked around and they called and they sent people out to sporting goods stores everywhere. And the result was there were no hockey garters anywhere available. And so, with a day or two to go to their first game against a rival town team in the next city, which was Portsmouth, New Hampshire, I've talked to two people that were there, and neither of them would tell me who it was that finally went out and did this, but they elected somebody to go to a woman's clothing store and to buy, in the extra large size, if possible, sufficient garters for the players to have in the first game. And so underneath the clothing, underneath the pants, and therefore not an unsightly thing for the enemy to see, were these bright pink garters, the only available color in the extra large size. And
I love it.
You just have to wonder what the game would have been like had someone been able to just catch a glimpse of those things and it became a topic on the ice of conversation.
I can imagine. Well, you've left a wonderful legacy, but also you give information about the NCAA selecting the U.S. Naval Academy to be a collegiate sponsor for 2009-4 Frozen Four National Men's Hockey Championship Finals to be played at the Verizon Center in Washington, D.C. You've got so many things in here. Here are men playing in their 70s and their 80s. I mean, that is amazing because hockey is a pretty tough game. Now, of course, it's not played like someone in their 20s might play it. But still, you guys are out there. What, I know we're almost out of time here, and I want to be sure that we give out your website. It's theryeseahawks.com, R-Y-E-Seahawks.com. What would you want to say to moms of today whose sons might want to get out and play this sport that many women would view as being, oh, just too harsh and too hard to play? What would you want them to know about the game?
Well, I have only daughters, but I have four grandsons, and I think probably the best advice I could give would be the advice I gave both those daughters and now a number of those grandsons who are playing hockey, and that is that the game of hockey is, if not the fastest, one of the fastest in the world, and playing that game with dedication will teach you many of the things that will make you a better citizen and a better man or woman when you grow up, and yet at the same time, the equipment, the regulations, the rinks themselves are all much improved over those that I saw, of course, that you've been describing so accurately, Donna, and therefore the game is played safely. It doesn't mean that in any contact game somebody cannot be hurt, but it is a very rare thing now to see a college player, a high school player, or the various levels of youth that learn the game from about the age of 4 or 5 on up to high school, having any injuries at all, other than maybe a muscle pull or something like that. It does happen, but it's a very rare thing, and certainly I would make the case that the injuries in hockey, as fast as that game seems to be, are actually much less statistically than are found in football, soccer, baseball, basketball.
Well, of course, today they've got better uniforms all the way around. It's just amazing, and the speed is incredible. Bruce Valley, his book, Seahawk, Confessions of an Old Hockey Goalie. Believe me, it is a joy to read, even if you aren't a sports buff. But if you've got somebody in your family who is, this would make a great gift for them. But more importantly, it gives you an understanding of the game, the way it was, what its teams were like back in the 40s and the 50s, and how the teams of today learned from the good and the bad sides of it, but how it has evolved in today's world and where it stands. Bruce, thank you so much for being my guest today. It's been a delight.
It's been my genuine pleasure, Donna. Thank you.
You're welcome. This is Donna Thiebaud. We're taking a break. When we come back, we've got more things to share. Don't go away.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Thiebaud. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Thiebaud to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
This is Donna Thiebaud. Hey, if you'd like to call in and chat with me, these are the telephone numbers you can call in to. Toll free, 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Worldwide, including the U.S., 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, if this is the first time that you've listened to the show and you're interested in contacting me, hey, all you need to do is give me your first name or initial, and then after that, I will tell you what I perceive. It's that simple. No games, no gimmicks, no magic wand. All I do is give you what I perceive, and then you're welcome to ask me a question about whatever you like. So whenever you want during this next half hour, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. It's coming up oh so quickly, April 25th, my class Mind Vision, Powering Up Your Inner Giant. That's what this all-day seminar is really going to be about. This is interactive. I really enjoy doing a class like this because it gives me an opportunity to be one-on-one with people. Now, this is going to be held at the Center for Spiritual Living at 206 North J Street in Tacoma, Washington. It's $95 for the class. However, and that includes a catered lunch. Yes, we have a catered lunch. And if you would like to attend, $95 is the fee, but you'll get a $10 discount if you make your reservation by the 23rd of this month. The telephone number to call in for reservations is either my office at 800-872-8852, or you can call 253-383-3151. That's 253-383-3151, or again, 800-872-8852, and MasterCard and Visa are accepted. Now, what is this class going to be all about? Well, we're going to be breaking up into segments. We'll be talking about the genius that resides within you, how you can change whatever isn't working in your life, and how do you want to design your future. Also, we're going to be dealing more with expanding intuition. I've had people request that they wanted to understand more about their intuitive processes and to develop them, so that's what we're going to do. So passion, direction, intuitive perception, we're going to have clarity on all of that, and it's just a delight to be able to do this. I don't do it very often, and when I do have the opportunity, it's really so much fun for me because I like being able to work one-on-one with people. So again, give me a buzz if you would like to have more information on this class. If you're in the Pacific Northwest, call me at 800-872-8852, and we'll reserve a spot just for you. Well, I want to share a thought with you. It's an idea that I think could be applied to many different types of situations. Could be in a family environment, could be in a business environment. But this is about a manager and monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a manager wanted to encourage the other managers within her company to really help each other out when things got to be heavy, hectic, and when there were deadlines. And, you know, sometimes people, if you have a bunch of departments in a company, they'll say, well, my department doesn't handle that. That's just not our stuff. But lots of times teamwork can get things done efficiently and well. So she remembered a phrase, this one woman manager, that she had heard many of those in lesser positions than her describe. Well, she said it was whenever they got to be overwhelmed. She said, talk about a monkey on their back. They were always having a monkey on their back. So what she did, she decided she was going to convince her peers to try out something to help each of them remove each other's monkeys. This is what she did. When a manager was helped by a colleague, he'd write a thank you note, log the incident in a communal logbook, and drop a little plastic monkey in a jar next to the logbook. The note provided a personal touch, the thank you note did. The log documented specific ways to help and who was expert at using them. And the rapidly filling jar of monkeys was a unique visual reminder that helping your peers isn't just monkey business. When I came across that information, I thought, wouldn't that be wonderful? A teacher could use it in a classroom, and there are those little plastic monkeys that are like a children's toy, and they can link together, and you can make a string of them. Well, if you were able to do that, and people could see, or children could see, how helping each other out can really make a difference, and also writing a thank you note. Why is it thank you notes have become so obsolete? Thank yous are always appreciated. I don't know why people seem to think that it's just out of place to send a thank you note, because it's really appreciated. And if you can see yourself receiving a thank you note, a handwritten thank you note from someone, how do you feel about that? Let me tell you what happened with someone that I'd interacted with a year ago. And this was at a particular event, and this gentleman had just done such a wonderful job to assist me. And believe me, he was being pressured by a lot of different people to do a lot of different things. And using my terminology, bent over backwards to assist me. And he never got irritable. He never got nasty. In fact, I was doing a show on the premises, and the person that was to be responsible for that had not come forth and delivered what their responsibility was supposed to have taken care of. This gentleman, and I'll call him Chuck. Chuck, when I said, "This is my dilemma, Chuck. Do you have any suggestions for me?" He said, "Give me a few minutes." So within like 7 minutes, he said, "I think I have someone for you. This is someone I know personally, and I have this person on my show." We went on air with literally only 5 minutes to get all of the material together. The gentleman that Chuck recommended was a dream. He was just so articulate. We had the best time on the air. And I sent Chuck a thank you note, handwritten. Well, I saw him this year. In fact, it was during the month of February at another event. And he made a point of saying to me how much he had appreciated that thank you note. Nobody ever writes him a thank you. He said, "I want you to know I've got it posted up on my bulletin board in my office. And I look at it, and every time I look at it, I feel good. That I want you to know how much of a difference you made." Now, that was just a little 2x3 thank you card stuck in an envelope, a 42-cent stamp on it. That's all. But it made a difference. Now, I share this story with you because when you can do things like that, it makes a difference. And that's what this manager, she said, when you do this, people feel appreciated. And sometimes, maybe it's not a card. If you have someone that's close by, maybe you bake them a batch of cookies, or you do something to show them how much they're appreciated. It gives the person a boost. Keep in mind, if that kind of action makes you feel good, do it for somebody else. And don't worry about being acknowledged or recognized or anything to do over it. Just know you're doing it for the right reasons. And you'll be surprised how that is going to benefit you in a very special way. You just never know. The old adage, what goes around comes around, I believe really, really is a true statement. It makes a difference. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227. I know. I didn't get it right. 876-5227. Worldwide, including the U.S., 888-815-9756. Now, tomorrow we're going to be talking about pet parenthood. Have you ever adopted a pet? Well, if you have, you know what it's like to go through all of the adjustments of bringing a pet into the home, and depending on the pet's age or the type of pet you have, it can really make a difference. Well, my guest, Diane Pomerantz, we're going to be talking with her tomorrow, and she's going to give us some tips if we're going to be going out and adopting an animal, what we should be aware of, what we should look for, and maybe if we know what we don't want, we can then be more readily open to finding what we really do want in the way of a pet. And then on Thursday, we're going to be talking about working with angels in everyday life. Do you believe in angels? How far back do angels go in history? Well, we'll find out about that and a little bit more from Carol May, who's going to be my guest on Thursday. And then on Friday, we're going to have an open mic day. That's right. No guest. It's going to be an open mic. They'll be able to call in at any time during the hour. So that's the lineup for this week. Just a wonderful grouping of guests. It's always so much fun to be able to bring them into your environment because they always have something to share. Now, we're going to be going on break. Give me a call if you'd like to chat. Also, what I want to do is give you some tips on gardening. Here in the Pacific Northwest, we had hail yesterday. Lots of icy stuff over the ground and decks of our entire environment. Now it's all melted and people are out in their gardens busy doing. Well, what can can we do to enhance our gardens? I'm going to give you some tips that comes from Duncan Crosby's book, Tips from the Old Gardeners. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
This is Pete Smith for OrthoTeb Health Shoes. OrthoTebs are completely heelless, invented by a doctor, and you'll burn 3 times the calories of regular walking in our sandals, 2 times the calories of regular walking in our clogs. They help you tone and trim the entire leg, thighs, bums, lower abs, and love handle area. They offer symptom improvement for people with plantar fasciitis and low back pain. Check them out on the web at www.orthoteb.net.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right, Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedros. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, for those of you that are gardeners out there, this is Donna Sebo. I've got some tips to share with you. If you'd like to call in and chat, 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. Toll free, just give me a buzz if, again, you want to chat with me. All I need is your first name or initial. We're all out there gardening when we have the opportunity to, because this is the time. Here in the Pacific Northwest, things are coming into bloom, and if you're a lover of roses, as I am, this is the time of year when you really want to put that fertilizer down, put down something that's going to keep the bugs away. But who would think that banana skins would make a difference with roses? Well, if you take old banana skins and put them just beneath the surface of the soil around their roots, the roses absolutely love them. Why? Because banana skins contain phosphates, calcium, sulfur, silica, sodium, and magnesium. Many times our soils are deficient in that. So this is something that, hey, if you eat bananas in your household, just save those skins, put them somewhere where you can, when your opportunity comes, you can put them around the roses. Something else that is an old gardener's tip, if you're planting new roses, and I didn't. I thought, you've got to be joking about this one. Take cooking lard. Yes, you can still buy it in many stores. You can buy it in bricks. You put it, a big, thick piece of it, beneath the roots before you bury the roses. And the fellow that put this information together, Duncan, he said his father was addicted to dripping, but if they could pry it away from him, this too went under the roses. Now, when he was talking about dripping, he meant drippings from bacon or meat drippings. That's all lard is. It's just been cleaned up. It doesn't have all the seasonings. In fact, lard has been, for those of you that are avid bakers, you know, lard is something that you use in pie crust. But the roses absolutely love it. They thrive on it. And I honestly don't know why, but he said it works underneath the roses. Also, beer is something that is used in many of the old-time gardeners' gardens. The one vegetable that absolutely thrives on it is cabbage. And if you just pour it on the cabbage, it's just absolutely wonderful. It's a beer, apparently, is a very good liquid food for flowers, especially the tall ones like your delphiniums and your hollyhocks. But they thrive on what it is. Well, you know, beer, before it was pasteurized, is really considered a food by many people throughout Europe. And it is something, if you have too much of it, you can get real fat real fast because of the high calorie level to it. But in and of itself, it was a food. It's just like wine is considered a food in Europe. Now, milk, if you'll take an empty carton of milk and fill it with water and shake it up well, you've got a very mild liquid manure that you can use on house plants or on plants and climbers growing against the walls of your house, and you will just find that the plants thrive on this. They just really, really like it. Tea leaves. Save your tea leaves. Put them out into the compost heap and put the tea bags out, too, because you can use those as well. And just go ahead and pour the tea on your plants. I do the same with the coffee. We use the coffee grounds. Just put them out on the plants, put them out on the ground, because it really works. So those are just a few tips that maybe will come in handy. And for those of you in the Pacific Northwest, I want you to know that if you want to have rainwater, just take rainwater, take a big container, and let the rainwater fill it in and dilute what remains in with your rainwater. If you have any nettles, they say if you put nettles in, it's really, really good. But just pour it around your plants. It's a good thing to do. Now, you may want to figure out a way to keep it covered so if the weather gets warmer, the mosquitoes won't be finding it a very nice place to have their residence. But it's fascinating how the things you have just around the house can enhance your garden, and it's not going to cost you a lot of money. Again, those are just some tips that I wanted to share with you, and I just find it fun and fascinating, and that's the Tips from the Old Gardeners by Duncan Crosby. Fascinating things. Are you getting late fees on your credit cards and wondering what you should do about it? Well, it's amazing. Apparently, people are complaining about credit card companies and how they are just happy as they can be to tack on huge fees. Even if your payment goes in on the right day, they're saying, well, if we don't have it by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you're going to be charged a late fee. Or they will not count your payment on time if a due date lands on a holiday or a weekend. Well, apparently some new rules have been developed to protect you from these runaway credit card fees, and it'll start in July of next year. Well, all you need to do is really call your credit company and tell them that you are certain you paid on time, you normally are not late, and you would appreciate it if they would forgive the charge, and many times they will. And they say, you know what, a lot of these companies do have the policy of waiving a late fee once a year. Sometimes the card companies will waive it twice a year. But if you're tardy all the time, it won't work after a while. Donna Sebo here, 877-876-5227-888-815-9756. Now don't forget, tomorrow we're going to be talking about animals, adoption, and how we can make our lives richer by choosing wisely the pets that we have. A little trivia before we close out today. Are you aware that Alaska, more than half of the coastline of the entire United States, is within the state of Alaska? Another point, the Amazon, we hear about this frequently, the Amazon rainforest, it in and of itself produces more than 20% of the world's oxygen supply, and the Amazon River pushes so much water into the Atlantic Ocean that more than 100 miles at sea off the mouth of the river, one can dip fresh water out of the ocean. The volume of water in the Amazon River is greater than the next 8 largest rivers in the world combined and 3 times the flow of all rivers in the United States. And going to the other extreme, Antarctica, it's the only land on our planet that's not owned by any country. 90% of the world's ice covers Antarctica. It represents 70% of all the fresh water in the world, and it's essentially a desert. The average yearly total precipitation is about 2 inches, and it's considered the driest place on the planet with an absolute humidity lower than the Gobi Desert. This is Donna Sebo. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Until tomorrow, same time, same place. We'll be right here with you, waiting, the Donna Sebo Show. Have a great day. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.